Good morning, everyone. This is Elliot Nagin. I'm the media director here at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Thanks for joining our call this morning. Just to remind you yet again, the Union of Concerned Scientists is an independent science-based advocacy group that has been a nuclear industry watchdog for 40 years. We are not for or against nuclear power. Our goal has always been to ensure that the industry operates its reactors as safely as possible. If we don't get to your question during this morning's briefing, please email us at media@ucsusa.org, and we'll get back to you as quickly as we can. If you have trouble getting everything down that you need from today's briefing, there will be a transcript and an audio file on our website later today. We may already have answers to some of your questions posted on our Frequently Asked Questions feature, and answers to more technical questions are on our All Things Nuclear org. allthingsnuclear.org blog. Yesterday, Dave Lockbaum posted annotated photographs on the blog of a typical boiling water reactor control room and the control room at the Unit 2 reactor at the Fukushima Daiichi site. It's clear from the photo taken on Saturday that the Unit 2 control room monitoring instruments are not functioning. As far as holding our daily press briefings later this week, we will not hold our daily press briefing tomorrow at 11 a.m. because Dave Lockbaum is testifying tomorrow morning on Capitol Hill. The hearing is being hosted by the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee and will run from 10 to noon, and we assume that the committee will be streaming that briefing tomorrow live on its website. We will email you information about that hearing later today. And we are trying to arrange to host our daily briefing tomorrow afternoon, and we'll confirm that in our email later today. After our speakers are done this morning and we open our phones to your questions, please ask only one question and, if necessary, one follow-up. And please mute your phone after you ask your question so the sound of your typing won't disturb everyone else. This morning, our speakers are David Lockbaum and Ed Lyman, who will update us on the latest developments in Japan. David is the director of UCS's Nuclear Safety Project. He is a nuclear engineer by training, and he worked at U.S. nuclear plants for 17 years. He also has worked as a safety trainer for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Dr. Edwin Lyman is a senior scientist in the UCS Global Security Program. Ed has a doctorate in physics and is an expert on nuclear plant design and the environmental and health effects of radiation. I will now turn the phone over to David Lockbaum.
Thank you, Elliot, and good morning. Over the weekend, workers were able to stop the injection of seawater into the reactor cores or reactor vessels on units 1, 2, and 3, and instead have been injecting fresh water into the reactor vessels for the three reactor cores. That's a step it's a positive sign in that fresh water and seawater provide cooling, but fresh water does it without the potentially corrosive effects that seawater introduce. So that was a step in a positive step to switch over from seawater injection to freshwater injection. Also, over the past few days, workers have been able to provide injection, albeit of seawater, into the spent fuel pools on units 2, 3, and 4 at Fukushima. Prior to that, using a fairly conventional makeup line that was being used on a daily basis prior to the earthquake. Up until that, those reconnections were made or reconfigurations were made, workers had been adding water to the spent fuel pools via water cannons from below and helicopter drops from above. So now there's a more conventional, reliable means of injecting water into the spent fuel pools on units 2, 3, and 4. As was established in midweek of last week, the spent fuel pools on units 5 and 6 are being cooled by the fairly normal system, with water being withdrawn, cooled, and then returned to the spent fuel pools by the normal lines. Those normal cooling systems on units 5 and 6 are now being powered by external power. For a while, they had been powered by the on-site emergency diesel generators, so they have units 5 and 6 are back to a fairly normal conventional cooling arrangement. There were reports of very highly contaminated water found in various buildings, the reactor buildings on units 1, 2, and 3, the turbine buildings on units 2, 3, difficult to determine where that water's coming from. It obviously shouldn't be there in those quantities, and it's posing some challenges to the workers as they try to carry out their restoration activities. But it's difficult from the data we've seen to determine how that water got into those locations. I think that's it, Elliot. Thank you.
Thank you, Dave. We'll now hear from Edwin Lyman.
Thank you, Elliot. There are also reports that the storage tanks where the water, excess water has been accumulated are full, and that they some of those tanks will have to be emptied before they can actually remove the contaminated water from the basements of the turbine buildings and reduce the radiation levels in those areas, which this seems to be a significant challenge. There's also a report of the leakage outside of the Unit 2 reactor building, and possibly even Units 1 and 3, very highly radioactive water, which is reported to have very high dose rates being emitted from that water. That, again, is a significant challenge. It's clear that the radiation protection measures that are being taken on site are haphazard at best. There are anecdotal reports of workers not being given dosimeters, ignoring alarms because of the assumption that they're wrong. And the incident over the weekend where TEPCO revised its estimate of the dose rate in the Unit 2 turbine building 100 times downward based on an incorrect reading of the presence of an isotope, iodine-134, which they should have realized couldn't have been there anyway because it should have all decayed away by now. So without having a good, an accurate program for monitoring radiation levels in all these various areas, it's hard to see how they can actually implement a program for protecting the workers adequately. There's also a lot of misinformation about what various doses mean. When it was reported that there was a dose rate of one sievert per hour, that is 1,000 millisievert per hour in the turbine building basement and near the contaminated water that's spilling outside. Some people point out that's four times the workers' allowed dose for the year under these emergency conditions. But it's worse than that because at that rate, acute effects and symptoms could show up within an hour or a little more than an hour being exposed to those levels. So it's not simply the cumulative effect and the impact on the workers' risk of cancer, but it's also the rate where they may suffer acute symptoms, and that would take things to another level. There are also indications over the weekend, looking at the IAEA monitoring results that they are reporting on their website, it appears that there were increases in observed deposition rates of iodine-131, cesium-137, many tens of kilometers away from the site. We put up a blog post over the weekend pointing out some questions about this data. It's very hard to interpret because of the way it's been presented, and we're calling the IAEA to do a service by trying to organize the data in a way that people can understand how conditions may be changing from day to day. That's all I have to say. Thank you.